This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an interview with Mr. Robert Turk. I am in Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech University, Special Collections Library Interview Room. Today is February 10th, 2003. Mr. Turk, you're in Coppell, Texas. And yes, and why don't we start, sir, with some biographical information on you. Tell me when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood.
I was born in Binghamton, New York, in August of 1945, and my father returned from, he was an Air Force pilot also, and he returned from the war just before I was born and separated, although he maintained his reserve status, and thus I lived in Binghamton for the first 7 years of my life. And then my dad went back in the service near the end of the Korean War, and then he remained in the service until he retired. And then so we moved all over the place. In the 50s, and the latter part of the 50s, we ended up in San Antonio, where I lived for 4 years, and went through most of high school. And then the early 62, we moved to California, where I graduated from high school, came back to Texas at Baylor University, where I was in the Air Force ROTC.
Okay. So your father, was he a pretty big influence on you joining the service or going through the ROTC program?
He let me choose, but he was kind of my idol, yes.
What was it like growing up in Binghamton? What do you remember?
Not very much. You know, we moved from there when I was seven. Main thing I remember is most of Dad's mom and my grandparents lived there, and at least for the first few years, most of the aunts and uncles did. But then everybody started scattering out all over the place. So, and we moved from Binghamton to Buffalo to San Antonio for training, over to Florida, and then up to Alabama. Main thing I remember about being in Alabama was those were the years that, that was the year that Rosa Parks refused to sit in the back of the bus. And I remember little bits and snippets of that. And then we moved up to Ohio and New York and then down to the San Antonio area.
So you moved quite a bit.
Right. Back then they had more money than they do now, I think.
How did you adjust to all the moving around?
The family was a very, very strong part of our growing up. Didn't have lifelong friends like a lot of my friends did, so the family was the basis of our security and safety, and that was pretty much the way it was. Until then, so I always thought there was something a little screwy with myself, until I got into college and found out that everybody was in kind of the same boat. It's just that it manifests itself differently with some others than it did with me. But it helped me come out of myself and be a little more extroverted than I probably would have been otherwise.
Okay. Did your mother work when you were growing up?
No.
Okay. How many siblings did you have?
I have a sister.
Okay. Is she older or younger?
She's younger.
Okay. And tell me about talking with your dad, if you did, about World War II and his service in the Air Force.
He never really talked about it too much until he just died a year or so ago. And he started to talk a little bit about it as he got older and more ill, but not very much. All they ever really told us was the reason they got married so early, and they were both 18 when they got married, was because the world was coming to an end and the war was starting. And so we have a very good family history. My mom did a picture book, if you will, of following Dad around all his training from, I think, 42, maybe 43 on to at the time that he went over in 40, I guess early 45.
Okay.
And he flew his missions, got shot down twice. He got shot down in his first mission and his last mission.
Oh, really?
He was interned in Switzerland at the end of the war, trying to escape.
So, wow. What did he fly? Was it
he was a B-24 pilot.
B-24s. Okay.
And then when he came back in, he ended up flying tankers, KC-97s, mm-hmm. until he eventually got changed over to B-52s.
Okay.
And so I spent most of my career trying to avoid SAC.
After having seen what it did to your dad and those yeah. involved in the Strategic Air Command.
I hardly ever got, my senior year, I hardly ever saw him.
Really?
Because he was either on alert or mm-hmm. briefing or debriefing from a flight.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't get to see him much my senior year.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about high school in San Antonio. Did you play sports?
Yeah, I wasn't a varsity quality athlete, but I played football, basketball, baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Some with school, some with like Pony League and
mm-hmm.
Babe Ruth League and stuff like that. But then I started working when I was about 15, and the money kind of helped, so I
mm-hmm.
ended up working. But I've always played sports.
What did you do? What was your work?
Oh, it was my first job was. What was the name of that place? I can't remember the name of the store. It was a discount chain store, and
mm-hmm.
when they found out I wasn't 16, they let me go, but I was helping them open up their store. That was my first job,
mm-hmm.
conflicting with my baseball schedule, and after that, it was, I just ended up working in a grocery store, I think, as a bag boy.
Okay. Did you continue playing sports in California? And you went there?
Yeah, but you can't, you know, senior year you come in, you can't play for a year because of eligibility. So I went out for football and got injured my foot. So I ended up dropping out of that, but I did play basketball.
Okay.
But again, I couldn't play varsity sports because I was a transfer.
Right.
They wouldn't let you come in until your second year.
Mm-hmm.
So I played what they called varsity ramblers, and we were just kind of a bunch of guys that went over, and nobody came to the games. We just had a good time.
Okay. What were your favorite subjects in high school?
Well, English, social studies, those kind of things.
Okay. Were you a good student or fair?
No, I wasn't any good. I probably could have done a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Basically a C-plus student.
Mm-hmm. And you went to Baylor, is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And was education emphasized in your household? Is that something that you're...
I was the first one to get a college degree.
Dad, really?
Dad was one of the last officers to be in service without a college degree,
mm-hmm.
which made it very difficult for him in the competition.
Right.
And he didn't make major for years. Matter of fact, there was only... See, he made major my senior year of college in 66, and then... I made captain in 70, so
wow.
There was only like 3 years there that there wasn't a captain in the family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But he retired as he never served as a lieutenant colonel, but he retired in reserves as a lieutenant colonel.
Okay. Okay. But, well, go ahead.
Yeah, they wanted me to do good in education, but mm-hmm. they didn't have any, I mean, it wasn't like, you know, here's how you do it.
Right. So how did you end up from California going back to Baylor? Over in Texas.
Well, I was. We grew, as I said, the family was very close, and we grew up. My folks were always in the Baptist Church.
Okay.
I've since left it, but they. That was the biggest Baptist school, and I applied to the Air Force Academy, and I was too late there. Plus, my grades probably wouldn't have even come close.
Mm-hmm.
But I was accepted to Baylor into California Baptist College, and
okay.
Went to Baylor. Back then, it was fairly inexpensive.
Mm-hmm.
It was the second cheapest private university in the country.
Wow.
The semester hours are like $15 a semester hour, so
hmm.
Yeah, I got my education fairly inexpensively, mm-hmm. but it was an excellent college for me.
What do you remember most about those years?
About Baylor?
Yes, sir.
I loved it. I just grew up and grew out and became more of an individual. I mean, it was one of the first things, even though Mom and Dad paid the bills, something that I did. I was in student government for 3 years and loved that. And if I had had a better grade point average, I'd have been. We had elections for who's who in college and all that, but mm-hmm. I had to have a 3.0, and I had like a 2.79 or something.
Mm-hmm. So you're a decent student.
Same thing. I was a C-plus student until I got into grad school.
Okay.
And then I began to get all A's, but
mm-hmm.
I don't think it wasn't because of anybody else. I just didn't apply myself.
Right. Well, how did you get into ROTC?
Well, my dad was in the service, and it just made sense to me. Vietnam was going on, and I kind of sensed that I wanted to fly, so this was going to be a way to do it. And I had good physical attributes, good eyesight, and coordination, and scored well on the AFLQT, and I just did that instead of having to do PT and stuff like that.
Okay. Now, you joined, when did you join, your freshman year, or was it your sophomore
year?
Yeah,
I was in Air Force ROTC the whole time.
Tell me about wanting to fly. When did that kind of enter in your mind? Was that when you were a boy, or was
I had books from when I was little. One of the first books I remember reading was Doolittle's 30 Seconds Over Tokyo.
Okay.
I think I still have that book somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And had another one called, I can't remember the name of it, I've got it tucked away somewhere too. Something about ace flying or something like that. And High Flight was always one of my favorite poems, even before I flew and really knew what it meant.
Mm-hmm.
So it just always fascinated me. I didn't do it very much when I was little, but Dad would fly Piper Cubs and stuff, and I'd go with him every once in a while.
When was the first time you ever flew with him?
When I was little, I remember going up with him in a friend's Piper Cub.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think one time off the record, he took me to out on the KC-97. They were not flying, but they were doing an engine check at the end of the runway. And so I got to taxi out there, and that was when I was pretty old then. I've been in high school.
Okay. It almost seems like you were destined to fly with your dad in the service.
My neighbor in San Antonio was also out there. He flew fighters, so he took me up with him in a private airplane a couple times, and I loved that, too.
Mm-hmm. When did you first actually get to fly yourself?
In ROTC.
Okay. Tell me about that experience.
I was one of the... I forget how many pilots, four or five that they had chosen, and we went through training there. And I soloed in November of 66.
Mm-hmm.
Out of all, I guess there were eight of us there at the college, and a lot of interesting experiences, and learning instruments and stuff. But
mm-hmm.
I wasn't really a very good pilot, but I was persistent, and we finished up, and only two of us finished out of that program. And
wow.
I think four of us graduated and went to pilot training, and only two of us finished.
Mm-hmm.
And the other guy was killed in a C-47 in Vietnam. So I'm the only one left out of that particular class.
Hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Well, you said you weren't a very good pilot. Why do you say that?
I'm not a natural.
Did it come hard to you?
I don't know. I had people, you know, I just wasn't a natural. So I had to work hard at it.
Mm-hmm.
And I always thought that if they didn't have a war, I probably wouldn't have made it through.
Really?
But they needed pilots. And
mm-hmm.
I didn't graduate at the bottom of my class, but I was... There was only, I was in one of the first classes at Randolph, and I think we lost a few to washouts, but when we got done, we had about 35 left, and I was probably in high 20s or early, low 30s. But I did get pretty much my choice because I knew I couldn't do a fighter and got cargo planes.
Now, you said you went to Randolph. Is that, was that your basic training there?
Yes.
Okay. When was that, 1966, when you graduated?
No, I entered in 67.
Okay,
And I finished in 68, or end of August.
Okay. What did you do in that intervening year after you graduated?
From college?
Mm-hmm.
I graduated from college in 67.
Okay, I thought it was 66. My fault.
No,
okay.
I graduated in 67 on one day. The next day I got married, and I worked for a couple months with the YMCA in Waco, and then I entered the Air Force down in San Antonio and went through pilot training.
Okay.
The year of 53 weeks, which is really 57 weeks.
Okay.
And we finished around, I think it was August 31st of 68.
How was basic training for you? Can you describe that for me?
It was the first thing I ever really did on my own, and I was very proud of my wings. We flew half days, and we had academics half days.
Mm-hmm.
And it flip-flopped every other week, whether you flew in the morning or the afternoon, and academics morning or afternoon. And it was just very well scheduled all the time.
Mm-hmm. Did you do okay with the academic portion of it?
Yeah, all except one class. Applied Aerodynamics did me in.
Really?
Yeah.
Did you find yourself improving as a pilot as you went through training?
Oh, I don't know about that. I remember my dad was in Vietnam while I was in pilot training.
What did he do over there?
He was, I think, base ops officer at Play 2.
Okay.
And so we were writing back and forth. So I sent him a letter one day when I was flying the T-38, and we went supersonic.
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I guess I'm the first one in the family to be supersonic. And he didn't say anything except congratulations and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But while I was in Vietnam later on, he was base support here at Carswell,
mm-hmm.
which was producing the F-111, FB-111, B-111, whatever you want to call it. So he sent me a letter over there and said, well, you may have been first, but I went many times more fast than you did.
Was this a friendly competition between the two of you, or just joking back and forth?
Yeah, he was just kidding. That's okay. About the only thing I ever remember him saying about that.
Really?
But yeah, and then when he got back from Vietnam in time to pin on my wings, so that was really cool.
That's neat.
He also pinned on my mom and my sister pinned on my bars.
Mm-hmm.
So he came down for graduation, and then he left for Nam, and I started pilot training, and he got back in time to see me finish. So
that's great.
Yeah, it was.
What did you know? I mean, I was going to ask you, what did you know about Vietnam? Were you keeping up with world events and what was going
on? Oh, yeah.
With your father there, of course you were.
Well, even before that in college, remember the 60s was pretty tumultuous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Baylor was backwater as far as that went. It wasn't any Berkeley by any means. But
right.
It was interesting. I was pretty much anti-war. So I was kind of tossing that around between that and really wanting to fly, and I decided I really wanted to fly more
mm-hmm.
than I wanted to be politically correct. But most of my friends were against the war for whatever their reasons were.
Mm-hmm.
And, so we had some demonstrations my senior year that were very interesting because Baylor, of course, is a religious school, and
mm-hmm.
I remember one of these demonstrations where these people were just praying for peace in front of the chapel, and people
mm-hmm.
would get around and yell at them and turn on water hoses and stupid things like that.
Hmm.
This one guy that I knew was a ministerial student was just yelling at him, fiends bugging out of his head. He was so angry with him. And he turned to me, and I was in my ROTC uniform because it was that day to wear it or something. And he turned to me, and he says, I can't believe you're not yelling at him, too. I just said, well, I can't believe you're a ministerial student. So there was a lot of high emotions and so on. But there weren't that many that were aware of or agreed with demonstrating. And they eventually we got around that. And so I was, like I said, I went on to pilot training and got to fly. And then, of course, my first assignment was over there. I was thinking about this, that I remember distinctly a four-phase approach to the war.
As far as U.S. policy is concerned?
Yeah, I was against policy, and I'm always against policy, so that doesn't bother me. But the way I personally felt about it was interesting in the sense that I was against the war, and I was just kind of like doing my job kind of a thing. Until the first time I got shot up pretty bad on a mission. And then I was kind of rabid about these guys are out to get me, and I want to get them first and that stuff. Even though I had no way of shooting back except to shoot a gun out the window. And then kind of a pensive phase, the third quarter, where, you know, these people are just kind of defending themselves. Kind of thing, and then the fourth quarter was, you know, I just hope I get out of here. And going back to kind of being against the whole thing, because one of the missions that I did was to fly with my commander. I was a lieutenant, you know, I wasn't any big deal over there, so I was flying with a commander one time, and we flew these two scientists around to show them the spray patterns that the ranch had been using in the northern part, and mostly in 2 Corps, some in I Corps, but mostly in 2 Corps. And so we flew for 4 or 5 hours one afternoon with these guys. And I was reading a magazine, what was the name of it? New Republic, which I thought was a pretty sharp magazine because it, well, it was like, this is much later, after I was back home, but it broke a lot of the Watergate stuff 6 to 8 months before the mainstream press did, about ITT scandals and the milk scandals and some other things. Anyway, these two guys' articles showed up while I was still in Vietnam, and their conclusions and so on, which I thought were precipitous, you know, without any other knowledge. They were, like, correlating data for birth defects in the civilian population to the missions. And what I was, I wasn't any great shakes academically or anything else, but I knew that they didn't have any data before that to compare it to, so there was absolutely no way, you know, someone would be able to say A caused B. So, and I thought that was always unfair. Because after all, we weren't accepted back in the States very well anyway. We were baby killers and everything else. With them not being scientific about it, it made the how would you say that? That made you feel like most of the comments really truly were unfair. So anyhow, I guess that really means anything, but.
Well, no, it does, and we can talk a bit more about your feelings toward the war in general a bit later. Before you went over and when you were in basic at Randolph, what were your attitudes toward the war? You said you're kind of an anti-war Baylor, but once you got back,
I was still
service,
anti-war.
Were you really?
Yeah.
How about the people that you were with, you know, your comrades there?
Most of them were pro-war.
Was there a reason that why you were anti-war? Did you feel like the United States did not need to be over there in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, from what the people that I ran with in college and the reading I was doing, I thought we had overstepped our bounds. But
why did you think the United States had committed itself to Southeast Asia by that point?
Well, I didn't know then what I know now about the falseness of the Tonkin Gulf resolution. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I just didn't feel like it was enough of a threat to merit our response.
Okay.
I'm not sure that I can verbalize that as much as I could back then, but mm-hmm. it's been a long time since I thought about it.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like your training at Randolph prepared you adequately for what you did in Vietnam?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'd have been dead if I wasn't.
Okay. What kind of weapons training did you have in your basic training there?
We just went through the pilot profile, you know, the T-37s, T-38s, mm-hmm. T-41s to start with. Mm-hmm. And that's what we did.
Which of those planes did you like the most?
I loved flying the 38 because it was so fast, but it took me a while to get used to it.
Now, because of the way you perform there, is that why you went into cargo flight?
Yes, I was not, like I said, I wasn't natural. My instructor pilot, and I started to tell you this earlier, but my instructor pilot, I remember this very distinctly, or my dad told me or something, told me that he normally worries about his students because he was never sure that they understood the magnitude of everything because he hadn't been able to show him everything, but he said in my case there was an exception because I'd made every possible mistake I could. So,
okay.
So, but for what that's worth.
So when you finished your basic, did you get to choose, or did you hope for where you wanted to go, or did they kind of assign you?
They had a list that came out. I can't remember how soon it was before we graduated, but they had this list, and it had all these airplanes listed. I've got that list somewhere in my records, but I can't remember. I can't find them right now. Mm-hmm. But I had picked all cargo airplane because I just figured that I was more suited to it. Mm-hmm. And so I picked the 123, and that was the one that I ended up getting. Mm-hmm. And some of the guys, I was happy that I got it. I mean, it was not something to brag about, but then it wasn't anything to be ashamed of either.
Mm-hmm. Where did you go for your training for the 123?
We went to Herbert Field, okay, in Florida, mm-hmm. and I studied, noticed that Jack Spey is one of the guys you've interviewed. He was my mm-hmm. instructor pilot.
Really?
He's a super guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he knew so much more. Of course, lieutenants don't know anything anyway, but
right.
He was a great instructor.
What did you learn? What did he teach you?
He taught me how to fly an airplane without being scared of it. Mm-hmm. He taught me to fly with, I don't mean to say that he disregarded instruments, but to fly in such a way that I learned things from him that I didn't have time to teach in basic mm-hmm. pilot training. They're trying to get you through the program. Mm-hmm. But Jack was, he was very, very good. He's probably the best instructor I ever had.
Okay. Does anything stand out in your mind, any incidents that happened, either during your basic or your advanced training at Hurlbut Field?
That would all be advanced training there at Hurlbut.
Right, right. But either at Randolph or at Hurlbut, does anything stand out in your mind, any incidents?
What?
Oh, just anything. Any particular incidents that you have in your memories about those times that stand out?
That was a good time, man. Everybody's flying. Everybody's having a good time. Good fellowship and camaraderie. Mm-hmm. Had a great group of guys in our class, and we shared a lot of times together and a lot of good times and bad times. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you're younger, you just kind of enjoy that stuff, I guess, and you don't appreciate it, but it really was a good time.
When did you finish your training there, your advanced training at Herbert Field?
Let's see. It was, I don't remember the exact date. It was, I think, January 69.
Okay. And you said in your questionnaire that you sort of volunteered for Vietnam. What do you mean by that?
Well, by the airplane that I picked and all that. I mean, that was the only place they were flying them. But there weren't very many, there weren't that many choices.
Mm-hmm. How did that come about, that you actually were assigned to Vietnam?
Well, I just got the 123, and that's where all the missions were. That's just the way it was.
Okay. How did you feel about going over there at that point?
I didn't mind. I mean, I didn't. No, I can't say that, I guess. It's just, I said earlier that my mom and dad had told me that the reason that they were the way they were, that they got married so young, was because, the world was coming to an end. And I got married, and my wife wanted to have a baby just in case I didn't come back. I think she's told me since then.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't particularly want to be there. I never did see my son until he was 11 months old.
Mm-hmm.
So I resented that. But I've always said that the war was, the flying was wonderful. It was just that if I could have come home on the weekends, I'd have been much happier.
Mm-hmm. How did you feel about going into a war zone? Did it bother you at all?
Nah. It's where the job was.
Okay. And how did you get over to Vietnam, exactly?
The longest damn flight I ever had in my life. I don't remember. I think it was 22 hours. We flew from Travis to the Philippines. That's where we were going to go to for jungler survival school.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all I remember, is I was in the middle seat all the way over there, and I read about two novels, and I couldn't sleep because I was in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I hate the middle of I will do almost anything to avoid the middle of a commercial flight.
Mm-hmm. What was the jungle survival school like?
It was kind of fun. It was what did we do? Let's see. We went through, compared to the survival school we had up at Fairchild, it was a piece of cake. But, we ended up going out in the jungle with the Negritos.
Mm-hmm.
And they would do stuff like we had an E&E thing after we did a few days training, and it was just a really almost fun time.
Oh, yeah.
To be out there like that, we shot off the survival rockets, and the Negrito kids would come out there and with their little slingshots try to shoot the little caps. We fling them out there like frisbees.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a real entertaining part of the time also.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a good thing. Plus, you didn't have to be in Vietnam, and you were getting credit for Vietnam, so
right.
That was another good part of it.
Were you there for 2 weeks?
Roughly.
Okay.
I can't remember the exact dates on that.
Okay. And where did you fly into Vietnam?
Into Saigon.
Okay. What were your first impressions when you got off the plane in Saigon?
It was just like in one of those movies. I can't remember which one it was. I think it was Platoon, where they show Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just like that. I mean, I felt like I was back there.
Really?
When I saw that in that movie.
Were you stationed there at Saigon, or were you shipped?
No, we were at Benoit.
Okay. How long did you stay there in Saigon?
Just somebody came and picked us up from the squadron.
Oh, okay. So very, very briefly.
Yeah, we weren't there very long because Benoit isn't that far away.
Right. And did they drive you up to Benoit or fly you?
Oh, it's just a short drive.
Okay. And what were your quarters like at Benoit? What was the base like?
Benoit was a dusty place. My particular quarters, since I was among the lowest ranking lieutenants, I was the only one that had a non-air-conditioned hooch. Mm-hmm. All I remember is the geckos and the John. Uh-huh. And when my son was born, my dad was able to call, and he got right to the hooch next door that had a phone, and I didn't have a phone in mine. So I heard the phone ringing, but they had the door locked, and I couldn't get to it. Mm. And so my announcement of my son's birth came in one of those yellow government notes.
Oh, really?
My son was born, and I still have that somewhere in my mementos.
Mm-hmm.
I can't find a lot of this stuff anymore. I'm getting old or something.
What were those first few days like for you, Benoit? How did you feel?
They took us. The ranch hands were a pretty hard drinking bunch. Mm-hmm. And they used about any excuse they could to have a party. The ranch hands were changing over from having the earlier part of the squadron history was pretty much all captains and above. And they pretty much would do whatever it took to try to get silver stars and all kinds of battle stuff for whatever reason.
What do you mean? What would they try to do?
They pick hard missions and where they knew they were going to get shot up, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some reason they didn't have younger pilots until about the time I got there, which was early 69.
Okay. So tell me about, you said they, how did people receive you there? How are your...
Everybody just, it's kind of like a fraternity, I think.
Really?
Yeah, they kind of like, here we go, you know, here's some new guys, let's get them acclimated so they can help out.
How do they acclimate you?
They just have drinking parties and... Some of the older guys were pretty good about helping us figure out what the mission was, it was just a good squadron. They took care of us as much as they could, but
mm-hmm.
we were lieutenants and they were all pretty much older than we were.
Mm-hmm.
But as the year went on, there was more and more lieutenants in the squadron, so
right.
Then we became the old heads. And we didn't get very many older pilots and navigators after that, I don't think.
What was your typical day like there?
In Benoit?
Yes.
They were different in Da Nang and Benoit.
Okay.
Benoit, I was like brand new and I didn't know what the heck was going on. I would be like a duty officer or something, which meant that I would coordinate, you know, just follow the book, whatever the book said to do for the duty officer. I don't really remember what I did, it just that I did a lot of stuff.
How much flying did you do?
Well, we'd fly pretty consistently, but it took about, I upgraded, I think, in April. I got there in March,
mm-hmm.
early part of March, and it took about a month to upgrade. So you had to fly several missions, and I just don't remember how. I don't have the training book or mm-hmm. anything to say how many it was.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a lot of missions, and remember that one of the more interesting things is that my wife and another guy's wife were together in a house, rental house in San Antonio,
mm-hmm.
and he got shot down on his co-pilot check.
Wow.
It was the only time we got a plane shot down that year.
Hmm.
And when we sent the message back, they got the part about getting shot, that he was all right, before they got the part of what happened. Because the way the stuff worked then,
mm-hmm.
as far as the mail and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So... It's just one of a bunch of stories like that, I guess.
What kind of training did they give you? Did you fly a mission the first time, just basically with your briefing, and then go out, or did you have to fly a certain number?
You just ride in what they call the jump seat.
Okay.
And usually they put you on something pretty interesting, like a heavy suppression mission or something, mm-hmm. pretty early on to see how you do, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How did you first experience being shot at or combat?
Well, that was, I don't know, it's kind of like fog, and, you know, it happened, and mm-hmm. you just kind of like, whoa. That's what it's like. Mm-hmm. And you just learn to focus on what you needed to get done to stay, you know. The first one was, I didn't get hit like that, but one of the guys had his interphone cord shot off, you know, cut in half. Mm-hmm. He couldn't talk to anybody. Mm-hmm. And when I remember one training mission was really funny. We had the pilot was a lieutenant colonel, and the head guy in the back that was running the spray machine was Hispanic, mm-hmm. and his language skills were difficult. It was difficult to understand him, and he had a Hispanic student that was even more difficult to understand, and we started getting shot up, and one of the bullets hit the pressurized hose in the plane, mm-hmm. which immediately turned it into fog. So all we can hear back there is Spanish. None of us spoke Spanish, so uh-huh. finally the colonel got on there and said, get the instructor on there. I got to find out what's going on. Because mm-hmm. he asked me to turn around. I couldn't see anything because mm-hmm. it was just a big, huge cloud. And finally we got, the second student was English speaking, so neither the instructor nor the first student could say, and he got somebody on there that spoke English, and that's when we found out it was just a hit in the hose. Mm-hmm. So we dumped our load and got out of there. But
how many missions would you usually fly during a day? Just one?
Two.
Okay.
Usually two. You usually get up. I'm thinking now, and I spent most of my time in Da Nang.
Okay, how long were you?
Detachment.
How long were you been WAF?
After I checked out as a co-pilot, I went up to Da Nang pretty soon. So it was in April, and I stayed at Da Nang until I got out. Mm-hmm. The flying was different because in the Da Nang, they mostly sprayed like down in flatlands. Mm-hmm. And the co-pilot job there was pretty much sit there and not do anything.
Were you the co-pilot or the pilot?
I was the co-pilot for 5 months, and then I checked out as an aircraft commander and became pilot. And I had 72 hits, 72 or 74 hits, and 60 of them were as a co-pilot, and only 12 to 14 as a pilot.
Okay.
Because I learned pretty quick that if you stayed low, they couldn't hit you.
Why was that?
Because you're going for it. If you're shooting a rifle, it's pretty hard to. Mm-hmm. And the lower you are, the harder it is to hit you.
Mm-hmm. How much would you get shot at every time you went out, or was it sporadically?
It was sporadic.
Okay.
We would usually know, and if we did a heavy suppression mission, where we had heavy fighter support, helicopters and all that around, mm-hmm. then we'd know there was going to be, that's the kind of mission that my friend got shot down on. Mm-hmm. Took a bullet into the aileron cable, and so they lost control of the wing, and if it hadn't been the fact they had three pilots, probably lost the plane. Mm. But one of the pilots worked the jet to provide thrust, which took over for the lift. When the wing would start dropping, mm-hmm. and they could do a straight-in approach, they ended up crash landing south of Benoit somewhere. But it was right in one of the places where there was a big army landing strip nearby.
Okay. Can you describe kind of what you would do on a mission? How would you go about it? Was it one plane, three planes, formation, things like that?
Well, in Benoit, they would fly bigger formations. Most of the missions in Da Nang were three-plane missions. Mm-hmm. If something was wrong, they'd do something like we did some two-plane missions, but tried to have at least three on target. Mm-hmm. Down south, like I said, it's more flat, mm-hmm. so they were trying to. I mean, most of the planes were down there, so that's why that was the case. Mm-hmm. But we did, up in the north, we did a lot of mountain flying, and so up there, the co-pilot would really have to, because the airplane was so heavy, it took the pilot both hands to fly it physically. Mm-hmm. So the co-pilot did the power. That's why if you're on a flat mission, co-pilot didn't have to do much, because he just got down there, set the power, and you motored along. But when you're flying up in the mountains, it was power off, power on, you know, going to max power, meter power, max power, and then perhaps even getting the jets in there if you got in a bind. Mm-hmm. So I liked the mountain flying a lot better because it was much more challenging. And because there weren't as many people up there, I was able to upgrade to aircraft commander faster. Mm-hmm. And we did some more interesting missions. We did a few crop dusting missions with Agent Blue instead of Agent Orange, because mm-hmm. They would grow farms in the bomb craters. Mm-hmm. And we'd go in there and spray that with Agent Blue to deny them some food up in the hostile areas.
Okay. How much support did you have? Did you have support flying with you every mission, or was it?
Yes, you always had fighters.
Okay.
And you also always had a FAC.
Okay.
The FAC would mark the beginning of the run. I was in the process of checking out as a lead pilot near the end of my tour, and had a conflict with my boss, and never did get to finish. But mission, well, being the lead pilot was a little bit different. You did more things than you did as a regular pilot. You know, you basically were in formation and you tried to stay on with lead, mm-hmm. and therefore the lead always had a navigator to plot our course, mm-hmm. so that we could correlate that into the herbicide spray patterns. Mm-hmm.
How about the effectiveness of the Agent Orange, the defoliant? Was it working?
Yeah.
How many times?
We had three different types of agents. We had agents white, orange, and blue. Mm-hmm. Basically, it worked. Blue would burn in 7 days. Orange would burn in 14, and white would burn in 21 days.
Okay.
And it worked sort of like when you and I fertilize our yards and got a bag of fertilizer and we put it in the spreader and it spills over the side in that particular spot, you know, mm-hmm. usually dies because it has too much fertilizer there, so it grows too fast. Mm-hmm. And that's pretty much the way it worked.
Okay. How many times would you have to spray one area?
I do not know the answer to that because it depends.
Okay.
We could get a burn, you know, but for instance, we'd spray along the Cambodian border. I remember spraying there one mission out of Benoit once, and it had a triple canopy type thing. Mm-hmm. And we were working on the top canopy, and that would take the top canopy off, and then we'd go in and go after the second canopy, the way I understand it, and then the third canopy so that air could, you know, the facts and so on, could see any movement down there along the trails.
Okay. How far off the ground were you? What altitude?
Our missions were always between 50 and 150 feet, which is why I say if I could fly my mission at 50 feet and not get hit, mm-hmm. but if I was at 100, I would get hit. So I flew a lot of missions down around 50 feet.
Right.
And if people were uncomfortable with that, they would be, like, pulling up on it. That's what caused the conflict with my boss about lead pilot. And the way our formations worked, you would stack up. In other words, the two-plane is higher than one, and three-plane is higher than two. So it made sense to me, lead pilot should be lower my boss was, I think, afraid of some stuff, and he kept staying up high. One day he tried to put me up in the clouds because he didn't realize that I had to be above him to stay in formation.
Mm-hmm.
So
you could see the ground really well. Did you ever see people, villages, flying over those? Or?
Sure.
Yeah?
Saw Army troops, too.
Yeah? What about the claims by the Army troops and some of the civilian population of Vietnam that they were sprayed with this stuff?
Of course they were. They were there.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't stop.
And how about...
One of the times we really got shut up bad was when we accidentally got over a pretty big town that had a huge South Vietnam flag flying.
Mm-hmm.
And we were really surprised we got shot up that bad. But the navigator got off a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I do not remember where that was exactly.
Okay.
It's been so long I hardly even remember any of the names anymore. But
how much contact did you have with the three agents themselves?
I was safety officer, so I went through them every day.
Really?
To walk through them. Mm-hmm. I didn't do anything stupid like drink it.
Mm-hmm.
But there were people who did.
Mm-hmm. Why were they doing that?
To show that they weren't harmless. They tried to show that.
Mm-hmm. And what's your opinion of it? Was that stuff harmless? Or was there any side effects?
I've been participating in the Agent Orange study for the government, mm-hmm. and we're in our last segment right now.
Mm-hmm.
My personal opinion, and it's only that because I'm not a doctor, is that the reaction to the agents is an allergic reaction.
Okay.
It may cause cancer and all this other stuff, but not everyone reacts to it the same way.
Okay.
But that's strictly an opinion.
Mm-hmm.
It's only because I know that all of us were exposed pretty much the same.
Mm-hmm.
Although in my job as a safety officer, I walked through this stuff a lot. And that was the only additional exposure I had. And like that time that the airplane was shot in the pressure hose and it filled like a cloud of that stuff, we were all
mm-hmm.
breathing it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it was on our skin.
Right.
But I didn't have to, I guess, live in it like if they were camped out and got sprayed. I don't know what that means, what difference there is.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, the guys on the ground did not all get it.
Right. Have you suffered any effects from it?
I don't think so.
Okay. Now, you said you were shot at quite a bit. Were you ever wounded?
No.
Anybody in your plane ever wounded?
No.
Okay.
Although there was one time we were coming, spraying down a hill, and we were making a turn at the bottom, and we took a bullet right in over the pilot's head. I was co-pilot.
Hmm.
I used to call him Magnet Ass because he'd always get shot.
Hmm.
He flew a little bit high, but the plexiglass hit us all, and I thought I'd been hit.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me, and it was pretty traumatic because it took a while to. I just remember the fact that the bullet came in and it kind of knocked us a little silly. We weren't really talking too much, and the guy in the back threw out the smoke grenade. The fighter saw the person who shot us and killed him. And meanwhile, the other fighter came in and put down some suppression fire with 20 millimeter to the side, scaring the living daylights out of us.
Mm-hmm.
This is like you haven't lived till you're flying 100 feet off the ground. You have 20 millimeter going off right next to you.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression, general impression of the enemy?
I don't think we were too much involved with the North Vietnamese. We were probably mostly with, you mean the people that shot at us?
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
I don't think most of them were. There were probably some VC that knew, they mostly knew not to shoot at us, but to shoot at the fighters. They wanted to get the fighters down.
Mm-hmm.
But they would shoot at us, and I think they were mostly farmers. Who were upset that their crops were getting taken out.
Mm-hmm. So these could have been South Vietnamese civilians firing?
Possibly, but I don't know.
Okay. How about tell me a little bit about your briefings you would have? Tell me about the intelligence you would get about hot zones, cold zones, what you could expect, where you should go, things like that.
You mean on the ground?
Sure, yeah.
Avoid?
Mm-hmm. You would be briefed before your missions, obviously.
Yeah. The lead pilot would get all the intelligence stuff, and he would pass it on to the crews.
Mm-hmm.
The only mission that I really remember that was going to be kind of awesome was the whole squadron was going to go spray over in Laos.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Blue, they were going after some target right near the border.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a brand new aircraft commander. I don't think I'd been on a mission yet as an aircraft commander, but I was going to be the number 8 ship in this 12 ship formation.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge deal. And the Army intelligence told them initially that they expected to lose 50% of the squadron to the fire, and the Air Force thought that would be okay.
Okay.
I didn't think it was okay, but the Air Force apparently did.
Uh-huh.
And then we were getting ready the night before, and the intelligence came in and it upped the estimate to 75% loss, and the Air Force canceled it.
Wow.
So, I was so young, I don't really remember that much except that the information came from the Army, and it was usually somewhat reliable.
Okay.
We knew where the arc light bombings were going to be. Occasionally we'd stray into something wrong, but most of the time we were pretty much up on the information to keep us out of harm's way.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever feel like the people on the ground shooting at you knew you guys were coming that day?
I think they did on some of the heavy suppression missions because it was a big show. You know, they had a lot of fighters and they had a lot of helicopters and they had us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in that case they knew, but it wouldn't have taken a rocket scientist to figure it out.
Why do you say that?
I mean, you got a big... If you're concentrating your facts and all of a sudden you get helicopters and you get fighters
mm-hmm.
in larger numbers. I mean, normally there were 2 with us, but sometimes we get more.
Mm-hmm.
Then they'd know that something was going to happen. And again, mm-hmm. they mostly shot at the fighters.
Right.
They'd take us if they could get us, but I was telling somebody the story the other day. I was spraying one time with my detachment commander up right on the DMZ in I Corps, and these guys, I think those were North Vietnamese. They had this machine gun nest right on the cliff,
mm-hmm.
and we, in this case, were stacked down. I don't know why either, but we were stacked down the hill, and so all they had to do is just put the machine gun level. And they could have hosed us pretty good, but they were after the lead plane, and they had the machine gun up.
Mm-hmm.
And the fighters got them, too.
Really?
Because they were exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But that was kind of an interesting situation.
Are there any other missions that stand out in your mind, looking back at those years?
I remember them, you know, when I'm shooting the breeze with people, I'll start remembering stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Different missions. There was a lot of interesting missions there. I didn't like being a co-pilot because some of the pilots didn't make really good decisions.
Really?
Well, that's like true of any pilot. You always think you're better than anybody else. So.
Was there ever a time where you had to take over the aircraft?
No. There was one time though. I went back and I told the ops officer, I never wanted to fly with that guy again because he liked to go real near the CARS formations, nearer than he needed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, the co-pilot did the power, and I could see where he was flying, and I said, you want more power so you can get over there? No, mm-hmm. I'll leave it like it is. And
mm-hmm.
we just barely cleared it.
Hmm.
And my most memorable mission was I had a co-pilot with me from down in the what we call the Flatland Ranch
mm-hmm.
down at Benoit. He came up to get a little more flying time, and we were spraying K Quezon, mm-hmm. long after the battle. But Quezon has a bunch of finger ridges near there, so in order to stay there, you have to put power off, power on. Mm-hmm. And so when we got down on target, I started calling power off, power on, telling them when to put the power on and when not to. And eventually I figured, well, you know, I've done it five or six times. You ought to get the idea. So mm-hmm. I didn't say something. We were down in this big valley next to a huge ridge, and he didn't put the power in. So then I started calling for power, and I looked over, and he just froze. He was looking at this mountain coming up in the windscreen. I said, give me power. And I reached over, and I hit the prop levers up and put the throttles to max, and we still weren't going to make it. So I said, give me the jets. And he's scared. He knows we're going to die. And I said, give me the jets. And he didn't get them, so I reached down. I hit every switch down there and got the jets up. Went right up the side of this mountain to about 2,000 feet. And my detachment commander is the number 3 airplane. I was number 2. He says, where are you going, Bob? My heart was beating. Boy, I thought we were... that was a little closer than I wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
But we continued spraying on into the out towards the east, and eventually got over the ocean and went in back into Da Nang and landed.
Mm-hmm.
I ruined the enlisted guy's tape that day, because I was swearing at that guy for at least a half an hour all the way in.
Uh-huh.
But no, he always killed us.
Were there any other missions that stand out?
I can't recall too many at this time.
Okay.
They might come back as we talk.
Okay. Okay. Tell me about life at Da Nang. What was the base like for you there?
We had our own little area within the officers' compound right near the BOQ, and the theater was right across the street, and we had racquetball courts, and chapel was nearby. Listed guys lived in a barracks on the other way,
mm-hmm.
On further away. We each had, there was either one or two of us in each room. And of course, Da Nang attracted a lot of rocket attacks, so mm-hmm. we'd get the, to this day, that certain kind of siren goes off, my stomach will twist.
Really?
Yeah.
What were the rocket attacks
like? They had nothing like standing out in the hall and wrapped in a towel, and that goes off, and you got to roll under the bed.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what were those rocket attacks like? Did you have a bunker you were assigned to run to, or not?
No, we didn't have a bunker there that I remember. Anyway, we pretty much kept our flak jacket under our beds and just rolled under there.
Okay.
There were up by the chow hall.
Mm-hmm.
There was a couple of days that was pretty bad, and they'd walk them down the flight line. We got one through the tail one day, and the rocket motor bounced off the tarmac and went through the tail.
Hmm.
One of the planes. Had another one under the plane I was supposed to fly that day, so we canceled to take care of all that stuff.
Mm-hmm. Did you have air-conditioned quarters at Da Nang?
Yes. Okay. Thank God for being a pilot.
What would you guys do for entertainment?
Oh, man, we'll go to the movie. That's about it.
Mm-hmm.
Had a lot of parties.
Yeah.
Drink. It was a hard drinking squadron. I didn't drink that much. But some of the other guys did.
How about drug use? Did you see any of that?
No. There may have been some of the enlisted guys.
Mm-hmm.
But it was pretty obvious there were some in the Army and so on and so forth. You could tell just walking by them.
Mm-hmm.
But I never saw any of the flight people that did it.
Okay.
Now, that doesn't mean they didn't. I just didn't see them.
Right. How much contact did you have with home?
Well, I was glad we did tapes and letters with my wife. And every once in a while, get one of the Mars calls.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, they came in bunches, so it would be very depressing when you didn't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
And if you got in an argument or something, then that was even doubly so.
What do you mean, like during a Mars call, or
no, no, this would be, Mars call is usually the way you get over with.
Uh-huh.
Think somebody was angry or something, and so you call, and it was pretty sad listening to some of the other calls while you're waiting, too.
Really?
Yeah.
What was it here?
Can we take a break for a minute?
Absolutely.
I need to go to the restroom.
Absolutely.
So.
Okay, sir. You were saying that during these Mars calls, it was hard to listen to some of what these guys were saying. Tell me about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, when you do a Mars call, they'd call you like one or two calls before your call would be placed.
Mm-hmm.
You'd listen into some really heartbreaking conversations. You usually only heard, you know, one side of it, but you could pretty well figure it out. You know,
right.
Dear John letters, stuff like that.
Oh, wow.
It was not good.
So you would actually hold on to the phone there and wait for your time to be patched in?
Yeah, because you were connecting to the person here or in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had their calls all lined up.
How many did you get to make?
When my son was born, I went down to Saigon and made one from the USO, which was the best call.
Mm-hmm.
Although I didn't figure out the time right, and I had to wake my wife up in the middle of the night. But
mm-hmm.
It was, I would say, every other month or so, five or six, maybe
okay.
During the course of the year.
Okay. How often would you write home?
Daily. And she would write to me daily. So,
but you said the letters would arrive in bunches sometimes?
Yeah. And we also did tapes.
Right.
And I've got the tapes, but I don't think I have a recorder anymore to listen to them. So.
Okay. How did you keep up with news back home in the United States, or did you?
I kept up, like I said, with the magazines that I read. I was taking, I think, Time at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And this New Republic, and I've always taken a lot of magazines,
okay.
So I would read those,
mm-hmm.
and I'd get them a little late, but most of them were not that crucial to know. And of course, you had the daily Stars and Stripes.
Right. Okay. Did you ever have any contact with the indigenous forces, the Vietnamese Air Force, or ARVN?
No.
Okay. What did you think of ongoing U.S. policy?
Wait a minute.
What?
ARVN being our southern, the South Vietnamese?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Not in a battle capacity, but when I was down in Saigon, or in Benoit,
mm-hmm.
in Benoit, I volunteered for a while to go out and teach English at mm-hmm. a Vietnamese orphanage.
Oh, really?
So that wasn't really through the ARVN, but they would, like, provide transportation out there.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guy, the headmaster would come and pick us up in this big black car.
Mm-hmm.
I went out there probably two times before I got transferred up to Da Nang.
Just two times?
Yeah, well, I was only there about 6 weeks.
Right. How did you get involved in that?
I don't remember. I just remember somebody saying, if this is something you want to do, you can do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I also tried to take classes, like an econ and so on.
Mm-hmm. How did you find the Vietnamese civilians?
You talking about, like, the Mamasans and all that?
Any of them, yeah. Whoever you had contact with.
Well, I really didn't have that much contact. The gentleman who ran the orphanage seemed to be quite competent. Kind of a Papa Bear kind of guy, but
mm-hmm.
If you think of the Mamasans, there were those that were pretty energetic, those that were totally lethargic, and those between.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't interface very much with any males, so it was just the Mamasans kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. How did you get on with them?
Okay. They did the job.
Did you learn to speak any Vietnamese while you were there?
No, I did not.
Okay. What did you think of ongoing U.S. policy while you were there? Did you follow did you see a course to the war? Did you see something that was kind of never-ending? Or what did you think about what was happening?
Well, I got the feeling that we were we're definitely spinning our wheels.
Okay.
The stuff that they kept denying was going on, you know, the raids into Laos, the raids into Cambodia. I don't know. I never felt that I had any real input into what was going on anyway. So I was just watching it just like I did when I was a college student. Funny thing though, I don't remember being the same feeling as I do that as I do about this stuff going on with Bush and Iraq now.
Why do you think that is?
Maybe I'm older and been shot at enough that I don't want anybody else to get shot at for stupid reasons.
Is that shape? Go ahead.
Yeah, maybe that's it. I mean, like I said, there when you first get shot at or after you've been shot at enough, you kind of say, hey, guys, I'm just doing my job. And so you kind of react strongly about that. About them shooting at you, and but I eventually figured out, you know, they were, like I said, farmers protecting their crops and stuff like that. But I never really had any. The policy I thought was wrong continued to be wrong. It bothered me, for instance, when I got back. The My Lai massacre trials and stuff like that, blaming things on the lieutenant when he knew darn well that the problems rolled way up farther than that. Even though the lieutenant made the mistakes and should have been held accountable. I do remember that. I thought that was just totally wrong. That even a captain wasn't enough. That kind of thinking went clear up into the command structure. But as I got further along, looking at my compatriots when I was a lieutenant colonel on staff at a base, I thought my contemporaries had the highest integrity and esteem. So it really doesn't match. I don't know. And then I wasn't in the Army, so I can't tell. The Army seemed to have a lot more problems than the Air Force did. But I did not agree with the government policy, but I had already decided I wanted to fly, so I abrogated that a little bit by going ahead and doing that. And I never felt like I could, I never wanted to spoil the uniform by doing something stupid in uniform. Because there's plenty of people who sacrificed a lot for us to have the freedoms we have.
What did you think of the leadership, the military leadership in Vietnam?
The immediate leadership?
The military leadership.
Yeah, the immediate leadership that I had experienced, the squadron, I thought, was and they kept things in perspective, and they knew what we needed to do, and they kept everything pretty well. You got up to the wing structure, and most of those guys are gunning for general. So they were trying to make themselves look good. And, we had, I can't remember the guy's name exactly, but He was a wing commander. He came and flew with us a couple times. That was like flying with a wet rag. He just didn't, it wasn't any fun, and he was entirely too serious about everything and not in a positive way. So we all figured out he wanted to make general, and that was what this tour for him was.
Right.
Was to do that. When you're a lieutenant, you might want to be a general, but you don't really see the way to do it yet, so you don't do stuff like that.
Right. What about the political leadership of the country during the Vietnam War?
I hate to give away my political leanings, but I always was more supportive of the Democrat leadership than the Republican. And, of course, Nixon took over while I was over there. I never did like Nixon at all.
Okay.
But none of those guys were in a position that they could do something straightforward because, you know, the way it either came to them or the way they had approached the problem. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that's the old man talking or the young man. I just didn't like Nixon as a person.
Okay.
Probably disliked him most of any president I've ever served under.
Tell me about the relationships that you formed with other men in your unit.
In Vietnam, they did want a room with me because I snored. So I pretty much was able to have my own room. And that's an interesting question. I had some friends that were very close that I'd gone through pilot training with that were in the squadron, but two of them stayed down in the south part. They weren't up here in the north. Mm-hmm. We were good friends, but and I'd fly down there once in a while and spend time with them. I don't recall any lifelong friendships from Vietnam.
Okay.
But that's mostly because we were all going different directions on the way back.
Mm-hmm.
I've kept up with from my pilot training class than from Vietnam.
Hmm.
That is a very interesting question. You're mostly just trying to get through it.
Okay.
And my approach was not the same as most. I didn't drink that much. Some of them did. Some of them had their own. I didn't have enough money to go buy the big, powerful tape decks that a lot of these guys, the bachelors, did. Because
mm-hmm.
I had a wife and kid, so I was just pretty much on my own.
Mm-hmm. Did that bother you, or did you?
No. Nah.
You're happy with that?
I'm pretty much that way anyway. So.
Okay. Did you ever see any racial issues amongst the men?
Not in our squadron overtly.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we were all very aware of the race problems.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to get in a situation where, well, the only time I can remember is when a bunch of us did get pretty well plastered, and we were coming back, and two of the biggest black guys I've ever seen. On the way home, and
mm-hmm.
one of my buddies said something like, "Hey, Black Power, brother," so on, and they just laughed at us because we were all so potted. But we're sensitive to it and tried to not provoke any incidents.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what you mean exactly, like a racial incident where something happened or...
Right, any of it.
I was kind of proud of the fact that I thought that people, they were able, if they had personal prejudices or whatever, they were able to subdue those.
Mm-hmm.
I don't recall any, to be honest with you.
Okay.
I remember more when I got back to the States than during Vietnam time.
Mm-hmm. What would you say was the bravest action you witnessed while in country?
Well, going into a known heavy target with, you know, just with eyes open and just
mm-hmm.
pressing on knowing you're going to get shot up, I guess is one way to say it.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of any individual act, per se.
Okay.
But the squadron was pretty good about, we did our job.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't know that we got shot up more than any other squadron, but I remember, I think it was 2,500 hit party that we had sometime during my tour there. That was a lot of hits. I don't
mm-hmm.
know if more, our job was particularly able to get hit.
Mm-hmm.
But, and sometimes they would troll for it a little bit, but for the most part, it was just our mission. We were
mm-hmm.
down low and slow, and they could hit us.
Mm-hmm. What do you think is the most humorous event you remember?
The humorous?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I got one of my tires shot out one day on a mission on one of those missions where we were out spraying Agent Blue in the farms,
mm-hmm.
and ended up, I didn't know it was shot out, and my crew chief didn't see it until we landed, and it was one of those oops, you know, and we were listed over right smack in the middle of Phan Rang Airport, so nobody could land over us,
mm-hmm.
or behind us. I guess some of the caribous could, but and they needed to go back to Da Nang and get a tire and fly it out. And so there we were, and we pretty much botched up traffic for most of the day,
mm-hmm.
except for helicopters and caribous.
Mm-hmm.
And my one of my other young cohorts did finally have to land because he was running out of gas, and he landed over top of us right after it happened. He
mm-hmm.
was, I was number two, he was number three. But he stopped it. Okay, there's plenty of runway.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of them. Little things like that.
Mm-hmm. What kind of entertainment, as far as USO shows, were you able to attend?
I was never able to attend any.
Really? Did you have a desire to go?
I wanted to go to the Bob Hope show at Christmas, but
mm-hmm.
I was not in any shape to go.
What do you mean?
That was the night that I was talking about that those of us that don't normally drink had gone to excess.
Okay.
And the show was the next day, and I just didn't feel like going.
Okay.
And I don't recall any other USO shows being there. I think there are more at Da Nang on the marine side,
mm-hmm.
over there on the west side, and we were on the east side.
Mm-hmm.
And so we just didn't. I don't really remember any other than the Bob Hope Christmas show, and that
right.
was on Christmas Day.
Right.
So.
What about R&Rs? Were you able to take any?
Yes.
Where
I
did
went
you?
To Hawaii. If I hadn't scheduled my wife to go back before me, I probably wouldn't have gone home with her.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So you were able to spend some time with her there?
Yeah.
How long did you have?
A week.
What did that do for you as far as recharging you for going back to Vietnam or the opposite?
I didn't want to go back. I don't know if anybody did, but it was something to look forward to, and it really happened. See, I got there in March, and so it was 8 months into the tour,
mm-hmm.
which meant that I was more than halfway, and
mm-hmm.
I knew that going back was not the end of the world, that I'd be going home soon.
Right. What did you think of the media coverage of the war, I guess then and now?
Well, it wasn't. I really don't know from the macro sense.
Mm-hmm.
But they they appeared to be trying to make the country think beyond the box of what should be. I mean, what America had before that was World War II, and, you know, when the heroes come home and all that other stuff. And so they were trying to show that this wasn't the same old war.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they did a pretty good job of that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were starting to cause doubt of some of the official positions, which we knew were false over there, body counts and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of trusted them quite a bit.
How about now, looking back on it?
I think they did a good job.
Okay.
Of course, the stuff like playing up Hanoi Jane and stuff like that, that's showboating. But
mm-hmm. Did you guys ever have any contact with the media while you were there?
I don't recall. I just remember flying those two scientists around.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell me how you returned from Vietnam. Did you know your specific date upon which you could go?
Well, it was roughly around Valentine's Day.
Okay.
And we all had those, I forget what they call it, the going home letters, and you'd send them back and forth and cross off the days.
Mm-hmm.
The same guy that was my co-pilot when he almost killed me at Quezon, mm-hmm. was also the administrative officer of the squadron. Mm-hmm. So when it was my turn to go, the squadron commander had made a rule that everybody's OER, or officer efficiency rating, had to be completed mm-hmm. before you left. So there was kind of a... he was typing mine while I was waiting to get on the airplane. Needless to say, back then they didn't have computers. Mm-hmm. And they didn't like a lot of typos, so he had to restart it a few times. Mm-hmm. And I grin and bear it.
Right.
And get out of the way. But it wasn't as high a rating as I had hoped it would be. But Lord only knows what that meant. Later on, in the long run, didn't mean much, I guess. But it wasn't as high as I thought it would be. But the neat thing was getting that piece of paper, jamming it in my briefcase, and running out there and being the last one on the airplane. They were holding the airplane for me.
Wow.
So it was like, I got to be in there in 10 minutes. You got to get this done. Mm-hmm. And so... I made it. I remember, I was listening to somebody talking about this the other day. Mm-hmm. I think it was Universal that as soon as the gear hit the bottom of the airplane coming up, everybody cheered.
Mm-hmm.
And we settled in for a much more pleasant ride back, even though it was probably similarly as long.
Mm-hmm.
But at least you were going home.
Right.
And I enjoyed it.
Do you remember what kind of reception you had when you returned back to the United States? Did you get out of uniform or did you stay in uniform?
I was probably in uniform. I landed at Travis.
Mm-hmm.
But don't forget I graduated from high school there.
Right.
So I had family friends.
Okay.
And I called them. And I think, I don't know how soon I did change because... they came out to pick me up. What I had planned to do was to stay there for a couple of days and go up to where I was going, which was Mather Air Force Base, which mm-hmm. is nearby, and get on the housing list and then go on leave mm-hmm. and go home and pick up my wife and child. And my folks, my dad was still in, so matter of fact, he was just getting ready to get my sister married, and then he was going to retire later that year. This mm-hmm. was in 1970.
Mm-hmm.
So I was calling them. The line was busy, and then I called them again, and they said, well, you're not going to do that. You're going to go home and right away, and then your dad's going to fly you out here on KC-97 mm-hmm. or a 131 or whatever it was he was flying. So that sounded good to me. I was anxious to get home to my wife and child.
Mm-hmm.
So they came and got me and took me to SFO, and I must have changed there into staying clothes and threw everything in bags and flew home and met my wife. And we hardest thing was driving again. Yeah.
What's that?
The hardest thing was driving again.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because I hadn't driven in a year.
Mm-hmm.
And she hadn't had anybody to live with for a year, so it was kind of an interesting adjustment for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
She was very, very young, so it was a traumatic adjustment. But no, I didn't have anybody spit on me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
So just went home and saw my baby for the first time, and
mm-hmm.
then a few days later we flew out from Texas to Mather, and first time my dad and I flew together.
Hmm.
So,
did you have any difficulty transitioning back to life in the United States?
Well, driving was hard.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, not to life, because I was in the military, you know, mm-hmm. we pretty much, but just in personal relationships, like I said, my wife had been living alone, taking care of the baby for a year,
mm-hmm.
and I've been living alone, being at war, and just getting that back in sync took quite a bit of effort.
Mm-hmm.
But it was rewarding. We've been married now 35, almost 36 years. So
that's great. How much did you talk about your Vietnam experience with other people?
Well, if they asked, I'd talk to them about it. Most of them don't care, so I don't talk to them.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, once I start remembering stories and
mm-hmm.
just get on a roll. Mm-hmm. Probably stupid stuff, but stuff I remember.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the continuing war effort in Vietnam? Had your opinion changed any?
No, I thought it was wrong. I knew we'd ultimately get out.
Mm-hmm.
The interesting thing was the squadron shut down in 71, shortly, you know, not too long after I was left.
Mm-hmm.
There was somebody was killed messing around. They moved, I think, from Benoit to Phan Rang, and somebody came in and did some sort of fancy pitch out and ended up crashing, killed a couple people. And it was long after that that they shut the squadron down. But the most interesting part to me, of course, was I was at Mather, and my wing commander had been a POW.
Mm-hmm.
And when all the rest of them got out, they really dumped on him because he was supposed to have not left, you know, when they had the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was ostracized. He was, I think, he either was on the list or was going to become a brigadier general.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a nice man. He was a friend of my father's.
Mm-hmm.
Had been a B-57 and shot down. Good commander. Liked working for him, but couldn't get over this thing when the POWs got back in, was it 73? 72?
Mm-hmm.
Can't remember what year it was, but I think it was 73 because I was in a T-43 at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And he lost his slot and ended up retiring out of there, which I thought was kind of interesting.
Mm-hmm. What was your opinion? Go ahead.
Understandable, but not, I didn't necessarily agree about it, but what I was going to say was I took another remote tour in 1975. With the United Nations, and I was serving in the Middle East,
mm-hmm.
and in Damascus, Syria, with a bunch of Russians.
Okay.
When Saigon fell.
Tell me about that. What were your feelings?
It was very interesting. I mean, I didn't have any feelings one way or the other, except that I was glad we were finally out of there.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of tried to provoke or evoke the response from me about it.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So, well, I never agreed with it in the first place. It also was the year of the Soyuz mission in space, where the
mm-hmm.
friendship mission in space, where we were together. It was kind of interesting, too.
Mm-hmm. Did they tease you about the Soyuz mission, or?
No, they overreacted a lot.
They what? Overreacted?
Overreacted a lot.
Yeah.
It gave a lot more import to things, I thought, than they merited. But
mm-hmm.
in any case, we the fall of Saigon, they kind of pimped me to see what I'd say, and I just didn't say much.
Did you think that the United States had withdrawn properly and kind of this peace with honor deal that Nixon and Kissinger had talked about? Was that something that you could agree with, or was that something that you didn't buy?
Politicians don't have to deal with honesty, so they can say whatever they want.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I don't know. I didn't have any real... I was just glad we were out of there.
Mm-hmm.
And however he wanted to do it. That was just about the only way to get out. Was to, you know, that was said many, many times. Let's just call the war over and say we won. And
mm-hmm.
that's kind of what we ended up doing. And it's okay with me.
What did you think of the Vietnamization policy of turning the war to the Vietnamese? Did you think they were capable of taking care of it?
Of course not. They didn't have a snowball's chance in hell.
Why was that? Because of them or the North or both?
The people in the North had more to fight for, in my opinion, than the people in the South. The people in the South were, you know, they were probably doing it for home and country, but they didn't really know why. Mm-hmm. People in the North had the socialist agenda drummed into them to the point where they became kind of automatons. Mm-hmm. That's just my opinion, but I think mm-hmm. that's why they were more, I don't want to call them just robots, but they had the feeling they were fighting for their own nationality. Mm-hmm. I think the South Vietnamese were like, yeah, well, it's what everybody else is doing, and here I am. I guess I better do it. Mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, I did not read and never have as deep in the histories as I have, say, in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. So I have a much better understanding of some of the relationships in the Middle East than I do that of Vietnam, mm-hmm. Southeast Asia.
So you haven't read a lot of books on the war, the Vietnam War?
I never really felt like doing it.
Why not?
Like I said, it was a year that I wanted to get through.
What did you think of the anti-war movement that went on in the United States during the war?
Well, I knew many of them. And I agreed with them. Mm-hmm. It was kind of a different era than now. You know, we've had a generation without real war mm-hmm. since Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And there were enough people there that very conscientiously objected to that kind of use of force for a political agenda, that it was not just something to do. They honestly believed that. And the reason I say that is my best friend was a CO. Mm-hmm. But he was a pastoral student, so he had an automatic exemption. And for some reason, he decided that he wanted to abrogate that and make his draft board identify him as a conscientious objector. Mm-hmm. So he had some big shooters, you know, writing stuff for him. Mm-hmm. He had, I can't remember, it was Reinhold or Richard Niebuhr, who was out of the Northwest. Or Columbia, I think it was Columbia University, one of those places. He had some people out of here in the state that were very high-powered, Cactus Jack, what's his last name? Kilgore. Mm-hmm. He had another guy, I can't remember his name right now, but he'd written a big theological dissertation back in the 60s, and then he had me, mm-hmm. and I'd lived with him in the dorm for like 3 years, and I spent at least half of the other year in a group together with him, and I knew that this guy was a conscientious objector, and this wasn't a bad or anything else. He honestly responds to everything as a conscientious objector did. Mm-hmm. So for whatever reason, he formed this trial, and I remember him telling me that he had all this high-powered help, but none of them mattered. What mattered was that I could tell him that I'd been to Vietnam, mm-hmm. been shot at, but I knew him and knew that he was truly a conscientious objector, mm-hmm. and that he would not respond with hostility to almost anything. So he said my letter actually carried more weight than all these big shooters did, because mm-hmm. I had all these medals and stuff from Vietnam.
What do you think about Vietnam today?
Well, I didn't leave anything over there. I don't want to go back. I thought it was a beautiful country that was really marred by all our bombings and stuff. Mm-hmm. you know, just physically beautiful. And there were some good people there. Well, I suppose it's just like anywhere else, but it was not a pleasant year, so I don't really want to go back.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States at all?
Some, but not a lot. Right now I'm a minister in the Methodist Church,
mm-hmm.
and we have some Vietnamese that attend here.
Okay.
So I minister them as well as I can,
mm-hmm.
having most of them were, you know, ousted in 75.
Mm-hmm.
One lady here has had a kidney transplant, a couple of them, and is very, very ill. She's a young lady, and so I've been really ministering to her and her family quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like I hate them. It's just I didn't leave anything over there that I want to go back for.
Right. If you could change anything about your experience there, what would it be?
Be able to go home on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you said that earlier.
That was a pretty lonely time, you know, just
mm-hmm.
being away from my family at a crucial time when our baby was brand new. And I just recently, when my dad died, I found some movies of my son.
Mm-hmm.
So for the first time ever, I saw him actually moving around as a baby.
Uh-huh.
I had a lot of still pictures, but I didn't have any movies.
Uh-huh.
And I didn't know they had these. So.
Right. How do you think the war has most affected your life? Or has it?
I felt like that year was gone, you know. It was, you know, people, you know, I don't know about you, but people talk about major things that happened, and
mm-hmm.
69 was the year of Woodstock.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't there. I wouldn't have been anyway, but because
mm-hmm.
I wasn't into that stuff either.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, it was a lost year as far as that's concerned.
What was the most?
But it did give me a perspective on life that I never would have had any other way.
Well, that was my question. Was that the most significant thing you think you took from that lost year?
I lost a year, but I have been shot at. I know what it's like.
Mm-hmm.
And I know war is not glorious.
Mm-hmm.
And I can talk to people about that. With some authority. I mean, I've at least been shot at.
Mm-hmm.
So when I don't agree with President Bush's particular position right now, I can say, well, look, I've been shot at.
Mm-hmm.
This is not something that's going to be fun. It's not glorious. It's not like in the movies.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see them starring in another movie next week. They're dead. They're gone.
Mm-hmm. What do you think the United States government took from Vietnam? Did it learn any lessons from its experience in Southeast Asia?
Yeah, I think that gave us the seeds for, you know, it's a bridge between our glorious experience of World War II, and then I think most people felt that we suffered a quote defeat, end
mm-hmm.
quote, which allowed something like Ronald Reagan to come in and say something like, well, I'm going to bring us back
mm-hmm.
to this glorious era of pre-Vietnam. And it worked. I mean, I think that's, hey, history's a cycle. And no matter what, there would have been a response to the war, even if we'd have, like, beat them in 2 years and come home.
Mm-hmm.
There would have been a response saying, you know, perhaps a little bit like what's going on now in Iraq because of what happened in the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
So, who knows? But I think that's what the U.S. took out of it, was we lost in the sense we didn't win the way we thought we should have.
Mm-hmm.
And that affected our politics and everything.
Mm-hmm. What would you tell a young person today about the Vietnam War?
Well, it depends on what they'd ask.
Well, if they ask,
I have done that. You know, one of the kids last year sixth grade or teacher or something, we'll had them go find a Vietnam veteran to interview. Mm-hmm. Usually around Veterans Day that happens.
Mm-hmm.
I just listen to whatever their questions are and answer them specifically as I can.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this is a good, you know, this is a good example of a person not, I mean, you can affect policy, but you really can't.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what the little girl asked me, but, you know, there were specific enough questions I could answer, and we don't get off into policy and stuff like that, because most of those kids couldn't handle it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that that fits in, if someone's a historian, I think it fits in with a historical response to anything like that.
Okay. Have you been to the wall in Washington?
Oh, yeah.
What was that like?
Very powerful. There are four of my friends on there.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them were instructor pilots of mine. And then one, the person that was in college with me. And then another one from pilot training. So that was, I don't know, I just think that that was a very fitting memorial.
Mm-hmm.
It's very powerful for those of us that have been there, and I, of course, cannot identify if I wasn't there. I've heard other people say it's powerful anyway, but
mm-hmm.
to put your hand on somebody's name, it's like touching them again.
The United States population today, I mean, that's one way they can remember Vietnam is through that memorial and through words of veterans, but they read books, they listen to Vietnam-era music, and they see movies about Vietnam. What do you think about that medium? That how this is how America kind of learns about this war, is through watching Mel Gibson. What do you think about the movies that have been made on Vietnam?
Mel Gibson, what did he do, Air America?
We did that. I wasn't thinking of that. I was actually thinking of We Were Soldiers.
You know, I haven't been watching very many war movies lately. The last one I really saw was Saving Private Ryan, which wasn't even about Vietnam. But it hurts so much to see that
mm-hmm.
type of thing. I do remember I saw Full Metal Jacket, and I couldn't sleep for like 2 days.
Why not?
I don't know. Except that it was just reminds me of times that I was over there.
Mm-hmm.
Deer Hunter, which I saw early on, didn't relate to it at all because of that was really a screwy movie.
Mm-hmm.
There was 1 year, I think, I don't know if it was 72, 73, somewhere in there where they had John Voight starring in Coming Home with, I think, Jane Fonda.
Mm-hmm.
And Sutherland or somebody like that. I thought that was the best of the three movies they had about coming home.
Okay.
Because I don't remember why. It's been years, so. But I thought, I can't remember the other movies either. But that one appeared to be more realistic because there was so much. I had a friend, for instance, whose wife cheated on him while he was over there, and it screwed him all up
mm-hmm.
for a long time.
While he was there or when he got back?
It happened while he was there. As a matter of fact, he got to go home one time in the middle of the year, and, of course, I didn't know what was going on, so I was kind of jealous of him getting to go home.
Mm-hmm.
But when I found out why, I wasn't jealous at all.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the human side as well as the conflict of the actual battle. And, of course, pilots, you know, we're abstract from that. The guys who are out in the jungle, they're the ones that probably really get screwed up
mm-hmm.
with those movies and reminding them. There's just a few scenes every once in a while. I just say, I've been there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I've done that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to do it again. But the movies were I did not think truly related to me specifically.
Mm-hmm. What about music from Vietnam? Is there anything that brings back that time period for you?
the one song that I truly wish I hadn't heard was Leaving on a Jet Plane, John Denver's song,
mm-hmm.
because left a pregnant wife on a jet plane and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That was the one song that always got me, and it still gets to me every once in a while.
Mm-hmm.
I'm getting a little better about it now, but just being away at that particular critical time. I'm a pretty much a family guy and somewhat of a loner, so that and the other one that I really remember is Bridge Over Troubled Waters, which came out while we were over there.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a Simon and Garfunkel hit.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sorry, I'm just, Richard, I'm not very adept at music stuff.
That's
Proud awesome. Mary and all that. I mean, every group over there sang Proud Mary, and that's the kind of song I remember that. And
mm-hmm.
just, there's some good music, and I'm not much of a music person.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why.
Do you suffer from any PTSD incidents at all, or did you?
I don't think so.
Okay.
The most visceral response that I've ever had was the siren and turning my stomach.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But then you just tell yourself, well, you're not there.
Right. What do you think about the U.S. government and the way it's taking care of its Vietnam veterans?
Well, like I said, I'm in the Agent Orange study,
mm-hmm.
and I thought that was pretty well managed, and I think it's going to be a landmark study case for that type of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what you know about it, but it's over 1,200 or so exposed and non-exposed people in double-blind study.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been covered over 20 years, and they're just about to finish up the last round. I did mine last summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just watched the results with some interest, which is why I say, my opinion is that it's just a lot of these people have allergic reactions to this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Not anything other than... one of the things I remember most is when I retired from the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
In 1988, I went over to Carswell over here, and the room was full of people retiring.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the enlisted guys and a couple of the officers, so there's a lot of people in there, insisted that the government had promised them health care for life. And I really don't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost like perhaps it was done by recruiters, not official policy. Because I could swear they specifically said they weren't. I mean, there was no guarantees beyond your time.
Mm-hmm.
They took great care of me while I was in. And through various things, of course, I've been working since in a couple of different careers. And I feel very adequately cared for. And I get kind of irritated with people who keep wanting to prick the government for a little more money.
Mm-hmm.
Here and there.
Right.
But that's my opinion, strictly my opinion.
Well, that's what this is about. Is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation today?
I can't think of any. You've asked some very good questions.
Okay.
Some I hadn't even thought of. Maybe I'll come up with some Salamic idea to call you back about and say, hey, put this on the tape.
Sure, sure.
But,
well, we'll go ahead and end the interview now with Robert Turk. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.